All right, so you might have heard Karen mention at one point Plains Road. This is Plains Road here. So traditionally, the turtles have been mostly north of here. However, I will say we're starting to see them crossing Plains Road, including on our most recent prescribed fire. So I want to talk about a couple of units here. The first one is the one that we just walked past here that you might have seen had a fair amount of standing dead aspen saplings in it, as well as a lovely understory of little bluestem. So this corner here where you see the dense little bluestem, this has been little bluestem for a significant amount of time. When it was little bluestem when Mass Wildlife spotted it in 2000, when I was taking a class with Dr. Patterson, we came out and did relevés line intercepts that started in the little bluestem field and then went off into the closed canopy pitch pine that's no longer closed canopy pitch pine. The unit south of here was dominated by pitch pine. However, it also had a significant amount of overstory aspen in it. The forester, when he specified this treatment here, neglected to retain the overstory aspen and do a drill and fill treatment or something to kill the aspen. And the result was that after it was essentially clear cut, because they left what pitch pine there was, it came back the following year to just a sea of aspen sprouts. It was within the first year, it was over your head and you just couldn't see through it. So we knew we had to do something about that. This is one of the few places on Mass Wildlife land where we have used herbicide to control native invasive species, in this case aspen. While it is a commonly found on drier sites like this, our feeling was that we have plenty of places where aspen will grow that we don't need to be taking up this particular habitat acre to have aspen on it. So we treated those aspen sprouts. We herbicided them in the spring of 2016. By the end of 2016, they had little bluestem already starting to grow underneath them. We came back this year and we did put fire through here, and you can see what the response of little bluestem has been underneath it. We have not seen any little bluestem in there. That's entirely from native seed blowing in or from the existing deep roots of little bluestem that were probably already there that were just hanging out and weren't very visible before. So the response to that has been incredible. You'll also notice what looks like it might have been burned or something here on the other side. This is an area which also had aspen in it. Much of this was a wildfire that burned north to northeast from here. When we removed the overstory of pitch pine in here, there were no living overstory aspens in this section here. The overstory aspens in here had been girdled and killed manually. But despite that, we still got a rapid response of aspen sprouting in here. This was herbicided just this last spring here. Our intention is to come back in here and we'll probably do an initial mechanical treatment to knock this down to make this fuel more available and then run fire through here. Did you want to talk about exotic invasive species while we're on the topic of herbicide?
Well, we might as well. I mean, when we were walking through those donuts, you may have seen there's some glossy buckthorn that's seeding in, and that's coming in from birds. As we do these treatments out here, we have to expect that that's likely to happen, that, you know, some of the birds will bring in seed. We really are very careful about washing equipment beforehand. It has to be power washed. before it can come on site. That's just a standard protocol that we use on all of our mechanical treatment areas, and it's really important that we do that. So we do have invasive species here. They're very low numbers, and even Glenn said that in his vegetation studies when he was working here. We now have mile a minute that has actually come in some of the landing areas, so we're watching that really carefully, and Alex one of the landing areas, not the others, but we're looking at all of those areas just to make sure that as we do these mechanical treatments and actually even taking on more scraping in some areas in those donuts, we're going to have to watch out for things like glossy buckthorn and other invasives and be very vigilant and tackle those very quickly.
So you might have heard mention about our largest remnant wild blue lupin population. That's off behind the herbicided area here. We did not herbicide the wild blue lupin. We left a buffer around that, and so we'll be doing some hand treatments immediately around that. So that's our seed source, or essentially. We'll also try to collect seeds from some of the other smaller populations along the power lines where we can find them, but many of those are down to just one or two plants of lupin in some cases. This year I managed to collect 600 viable lupin seeds. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a start. If we can get 300 plants out of that, after losses for germination and for seedling death, then that's 300 more lupin. That will more than double our population. And we're going to do some direct seeding of that. Just as I had mentioned with a little blue stem for the wild blue lupin, we are going to do some direct seeding of that, so dormant season seeding, and probably do some of that right here in the bare sandy areas in among this little blue stem, and then some of it we will have a contractor grow out in the greenhouse, and then we will plant those in plugs in those scraped areas in the donut units.
Chris, did you want to say something about mechanical treatments and combination treatments?
We had a quick question here first, and then we'll.
Okay.
Wondered what percent of the seed you're harvesting of the lupin off plants.
The thing with wild blue lupin is when the seed's fully ripe and the pods open up, they shed the seed and plant themselves. So you have to pick it just before that, which is always, it's like, taking the water or the milk off the stove before it boils. It's a little hard to figure out when they're going to open up. But there are some tricks you can use in terms of the seed. The seed pods start to be yellow, they start to get speckled, and you can shake them and they rattle a little bit. So by the time, I was out there on a regular basis, by the time any of the seeds were starting to rattle, at least 10% of the seed pods had already opened and dispersed themselves. I then picked rattly seeds for 2 days, separated by about a week. In each case, I picked about 50% of the seeds that were ripe at that moment. I suspect probably it was somewhere around 30% of the seed pods that we managed to pick. 70% of them essentially reseeded in that area. But what we're finding is because we haven't been able to get fire in there, and we have a buildup of thatch, we have competing vegetation that we're constantly hand pulling and cutting in there, we see some recruitment of new individuals from native seed, but a lot of that seed is essentially being wasted. So I don't feel that there's a problem with harvesting as much as 30% of the seed. Basically, we're harvesting what we can.
Thanks.
So, Chris, where did you go? Did we lose Chris?
Yeah, he kind of, not sure where he went there.
Right.
The last stop.
So I think what Chris would have said here was that, we're looking at a combination of mechanical treatment, herbicide, prescribed fire to really enhance this lupin area and see if we can actually get more bare open sand in there, and so it's going to take a few years, but this is slated for prescribed fire next, well, hopefully next year.
Or maybe even this year.
If we get the break cut right there. And then this is a 23-acre burn unit that was done on
June 20th.
So June 21st.
The one other thing that I'll say is, the forest here was thin, other than this wildfire area in the center here, the forest here was thinned in 2015. We then mowed the understory, and you can see it's come back to, it came back to a lot of aspen and gray birch and that sort of thing, which has now been herbicided. What's impressive is once we herbicided that understory, we just walked through here last week, and it's amazing how from a early spring herbicide in there, the understory, a lot, the ground vegetation now is already coming back to little blue stem. You know, a lot of these species that we're expecting to get after we've had fire in there a few times, we're already seeing them start to come in there. So we think that with some additional intensive management here, with knocking those fuels down, getting fire on the ground here, that we're a lot further along on our restoration effort in this area than we thought we were.
You may have said this before, in these areas that were logged recently or yep. cleared, or thinned, was the material mostly taken off-site, or was it...
It was mostly taken off-site. So we had the initial ones that we did, we had the bowls were taken off-site, tops were essentially left on the ground, and then when the mower mulcher came through, we ended up with a bed of chips that essentially made it almost impossible for us to put prescribed fire on the ground.
Right.
Our second attempt, which is at stop number two, was, well, I have a great idea. We're going to take the bowls out and let's just pile the tops and all the slash, and then we'll burn the piles. Bill, how many piles did we have?
220.
And how many did we burn?
I burned 40 of them, and I still hate you guys.
I think we got up to about 130 of them.
Yeah. So
these are not, you know, brush piles we're used to. They're, as Joel, he was at UMass for pre-study at the time then, and they were 20 feet across and 20 feet high, and contained a lot of 5-10 inch diameter.
Oh, right. So that didn't work either. And in fact, you may have seen that one of the subunits that we had burned on May 30th was called brush piles, mm-hmm. because it had the remaining 70 brush piles. They were at this point down to about 2 feet high, and it was just a lovely bed of rotten wood. But there was enough fuel in there, and it was dry enough that if we got fire in there, it was going to be a problem. So along the edge, we had to pre-treat those. We actually foamed them, and actually, I don't think we foamed them, but we
put some of them were
some
foamed.
Some of them were foamed. in any case, so that wasn't going to work. So then we switched to whole tree harvesting.
There actually was a market for the stuff that they left.
Yes. Yep.
They took it to Nova Scotia and made cabinets and brought them back to Cape Cod or something.
Yeah. So some of the pitch pine logs in the initial harvest, they actually were sold to things. Other ones in the initial harvest were chipped and taken up for biomass plants.
So that was able to supplement the contract.
So that biomass market for electric power generation picked up in the 2010 to until recently, where now it's dying again. And so we were able to get a fair amount of this work done, because even where there was no market for the pitch pine logs, or we were just taking out so much material that was not merchantable, there was a market for the chips. They're very dense, they burn really well, they got a premium for them at the mill, or at the power plant rather. It's sustainably harvested, because there's an exception for forest residues from fire adapted ecosystems, which discounts us. So they were able to get the benefit. So
most recent harvest as well?
The most recent harvest, the one you just looked at, that one actually, bowls all went to Canada. The tops were all mulched through a big grinder, and because that was bought by a contractor in Amherst who has a bark mulch business, and so it's probably still sitting in piles there because they usually stock 2 or 3 years worth of wood chips.
And from a market standpoint, did you pay or did you receive?
We received money for the thinning for all except for the 2014 harvest. In 2014, we thought, well, we're getting this money coming in for the harvest, and then we're paying money out to do the understory shrub mulching. Why don't we put it out as a single bid, and because we didn't have any money for mowing that year, and that way it'll subsidize it and it'll be great. Not thinking about the fact that as soon as we pay anyone with the state, now everything has to be done under prevailing wage. And so, whereas before we were being paid for a nominal amount for the material, and then we were paying about $400 to $500 an acre for the shrub mowing, in 2014, we paid over $1,200 an acre for the combination of removing the trees and the shrubs.
And I'll just say that's cheap compared to where I'm
right, yeah. Well, so, yeah. So just to get the marketing story straight, the first harvesting year was done in 2003-2004.
That's right.
It was done at stop one using a brontosaurus. I think they cleared about 20 acres and they paid upwards of $45,000 to get that done. Yep. And that's when the DFMW said, this is not sustainable. And they progressed.
Good question back here.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, speaking to what Chris was saying about community, I myself, Bill, a bunch of undergrads, spent hundreds of person hours brush cutting aspen after that wildfire here.
Yep.
We burned in here at least twice. Chris had done some selective herbicide at the Lupin. And then I think it was 2011, on a Saturday morning, I came here with my oldest son, and there was a hognose snake down the road, a black racer here, and that's the first time that the upright bindweed, which is one of the rarest plants in Western Mass at this point, just won flower all of a sudden. You know, all this, everybody is focused on blue lupin for so long, and it's very inconspicuous until it flowers, and then all of a sudden there it was. And it turned out there were between 1 and 200 plants at its peak, just in this half acre to an acre here. At least June 2nd, there were a bunch of plants here. I haven't seen any since then, but I like blue lupin, but the success story of resurrecting what I think is one of the rarest plants in the area was pretty phenomenal. And that speaks to the community. It was here, it wants to be here. And this was an old homestead site, if I'm not mistaken.
So that's true, it was full of junk. The May 26th, 2006 fire when I was down in Annapolis, Maryland at a nephew's graduation. I emphasize I was out of state. It was started by somebody shooting fireworks into brush piles that we created right along the road.
It was Roman Campbell's right here.
Yeah, right here somewhere. I don't recognize it. And you can talk to Grima about my interest in herbicides, but I don't think this was Agent Orange, Peter. But I got my start in herbiciding aspen in 1967 in Itasca State Park, spraying Agent Orange on aspen and basil.
This was the cornfield, the last cornfield on the plains in 1963.
And that's another important legacy thing, and you might consider if there are some subtle effects here. Glenn has shown that where there is aspen here, those are sites where that had been fertilized with calcium,
yeah,
corn.
Yep. Makes sense.
And so if you want to look at it that way, you could say that this aspen is exotic.
Yep.
Just makes as sense. If there was corn
yep.
here.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
And grouse hunters may have a different view right. of, you know.
Well, actually, I'm going to ask Dave Fuller, right here, to talk a little bit about grouse and fire and scrub oak and the plains and all that.
Yeah, I gotta admit, I don't know a lot about it, but you know, from a game manager's point of view, we like aspen for all game. So I always cringe when I see it being killed. there's not enough of it in the valley, in my opinion. So, on the management areas that we manage. Did a little bit of research recently, and it appears that, you know, fire and prescribed fire is great for grouse management, so I'm a proponent of that. If we can do more of it in, you know, some of the upland forests that we have, if there's a way to do that, I think we're going to gain in our grouse population, in my opinion. So.
Yeah, I can, just walking around here the last 10 years or so, we did have seen woodcock here using the Aspens before they were herbicides.
Yeah.
But there are lots of other game birds throughout the Sand Plains. Rough grouse, we do have them. And I think we've had some nests of woodcock in other places. We've had lots of kind of random strange birds. We had a mallard once nesting in the scrub oak. And there's also turkeys all over the place out here nesting. We'll often, in the scrub oak and tree pitch pine and in the power lines, they're nesting. So there's definitely lots of turkeys that are using this habitat.
All right, any other questions about this particular management, about herbicide? Yes,
John. Yeah, Brian, there was Jeff and Polly were asking, coming from the last one about basal areas, can you give some numbers on basal areas, residual basal areas? Maybe more on the last plot than this, but...
So on the last plot, our residual basal area, I would say, is higher than I wanted.
Uh-huh.
Our target was actually based not on basal area, but specifically on canopy coverage. Although the two are closely related and one is often used as a proxy for another, what our goal there was to make sure that we got enough light on the ground, that we opened it up enough. My instructions to the logger, aside from what was written in the cutting plan in terms of residual basal area, was specifically to make sure that there were areas that were mostly open, so maybe, you know, 5% retained canopy, and areas that were maybe 30 to 40% residual canopy, with an average somewhere around 20 to 30% residual canopy cover. Now, what's the basal area on that? It turns out it really depends on Montague Plains because the pitch pine depends on how healthy the pitch pine is. If you look behind you, you can see here a relatively small diameter pitch pine there with a really healthy live crown. And you will find other places where you have a pitch pine that's 20 inches DBH with a crown that's essentially the same size around. So I really didn't want to focus on although I had to put the numbers in for the cutting plan, what I really cared about was the residual canopy.
For other people, the original work based on what Matt did was 20 square feet per acre.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's how it was marked.
And so those initial ones that we did, and we did that especially along Lake Pleasant Road, one of the things that we found is that when we started trying to burn in some of those areas, Tim had mentioned this, that with the when we were down at 20 square feet per acre, that there was so much sun on the ground and so much wind that we would go from not being able to burn because it was too wet to not being able to burn because it was too dry in a very short period of time. When we did other areas on the plains, we pushed that up from 20 up to maybe 30 square feet of residual basal area per acre, specifically to say, all right, we know that eventually we're going to want to get down there, but we're going to get that with overstory mortality from burns and from blowdown, but let's have a little bit more shade now so that maybe we can expand out that time between the too wet to the too dry so we can actually get in there and have a larger burn window.
How did you apply the herbicide?
This was done with a team of people from VCS using backpack mist blowers.
Oh, okay.
So they grid it out and they blow every single individual tree and do a pretty good job of of not getting the other ones.
Yeah.
Although in this case, I did tell them that they're getting paid to herbicide the aspen, but if they happened to herbicide red maple and gray birch, I wasn't going to complain. And even if they hit an occasional tree oak, that was okay, because we want to reduce the overall tree canopy as well.
Once that contract herbicide is done, it's easier for us to come back in and do the spot treatments.
Right. So we actually, our staff will be treating, for example, that buffer that I talked about around the blue lupin. We'll be, you know, hand treating that, and then some of the competing vegetation that's in among the lupin as well will be some of the sweet fern is going to be treated. That'll probably be done with, I don't know if we decided to do glove wipe or we were going to use a backpack sprayer.
Backpack sprayers. For the
outside. Did you have them spray the cannabis too?
I didn't find any this year.
We found it sprinkling out here.
Oh yeah, so especially when we still had a lot of closed canopy pitch pine, this was a very private place out here, and so people came out here to do all the things that society frowned on. Everything from dumping refrigerators to clearing some brush to put in your big cannabis plantations, to dumping your cars and lighting them on fire, to everything else. Oh, and of course, target shooting, which is not allowed on a WMA, but especially out in the sand pits. People love to set up little ad hoc targets and do plinking. A lot of broken glass in there, and...
Bullet whizzed by my head, but I was up in a tree.
Yeah, so people are thinking, they're like shooting, like, there's nothing out here but trees, not thinking that 30 feet up in that tree is some researcher wondering why there's bullets whizzing by him.
It wasn't once in a million, because Glenn had the same thing happen.
Glenn had it happen to me, too.
We had that, too, yeah.
Yeah. And I was happy that it whizzed by.
And I will say, although we still have those management problems, although we still have dumping and all of that, since we've been more active here on site with more management going on, with putting in gates, with just a lot more attention to this, Dave will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm seeing a lot less dumping. I'm seeing a lot less motor vehicle traffic that's not allowed.
These roads wouldn't have grass growing in them. They'd be beaten down.
So the Plains Road, for example, just to let you know, this is legally a town road still. We're working to get it discontinued in here, but yeah, just be careful. It's a very busy highway here. All right, any other questions before we move on? Oh, yes, the box up there. Anyone have any guesses what that might be?
I think it's a camera.
Ah, he thinks it's a camera. Yes, it is. It's a camera. Again, I mentioned dumping. Actually, our video camera warning sign is gone. Someone must have stolen it.
Well, we have one up there. At the boundary.
Okay, so we have signs that say this area is under video surveillance, and on a sporadic basis, the district will come out here and put a camera up in there. And do these ones have the go straight to the internet or not?
These
ones go. Yeah, so they can go look up on the internet and say, hey, is there anything going on that we need to tell the environmental police about? So
my boss actually said I was at work today.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So biological interest, one of the things we observed when we started leaving pine was way too much advanced regeneration within 5 or 10 years from seed. And I started looking around and would see 2 or 3 trees like that, and my recommendation was that you take those trees down. If you're going to take a tree down, take one that has full of seed, because regenerating pitch pine is not a problem out here.
Right.
It is some other places, but not here.
Yeah. And one issue we do have over the long term that I've been asked at on many of these walks is, what's your plan if you're going to be in here burning every 3 to 10 years and applying mechanical treatments? What's your plan for the next generation of overstory trees? Because if we burn every 3 to 10 years, we're not going to have any new mature trees coming in. And the answer is, we're never going to be treating every single acre here in the plains. Even though it might seem that way to some people who have watched all of the thinning that's going on, our goal is to take a lot of these things, areas that were small units, and to expand them out into larger and larger units, and then to essentially have that shifting mosaic across the landscape. So while the average return interval might be 3 to 10 years, there will be places where we allow it to go longer. And we've also seen, especially for the hardwoods, for the oaks in particular, that they often will survive those surface fires, and we're getting recruitment of oak relatively easily.
And recruitment of pitch pine.
And we're getting recruitment of pitch pines, because again, even if you can see some of these smaller pitch pine in here, if we come in, that in among those aspen, if we come in here and run a fire through there, that one's probably big enough to survive now. And this has been less than 10 years since this was last.
Well, and if it doesn't survive, that stem doesn't survive, it'll sprout.
It'll sprout, right. So we will at least have the mature root systems, and there's enough acres here that some of those are going to make it into the overstory eventually.
Our work on intro, so 2 or 3 years, and it finally will sprout some of those.
The prevailing evidence says that this was an oak-dominated system that got turned into a conifer-dominated
system. Yeah, it sounds.
So that's fire behavior-wise, that's a very different system. Also, vegetation control services makes most of their money treating.
This will be good.
Where's the environmental place at?
Oh, he's going to make sure he's got a registration. If his vehicle's registered, he's okay.
It's the town road, right?
It's the town road. But if it's not registered... We'll see. If he stops and turns around, we know that he's... Yep. Registered vehicles, they're good. Those are street legal vehicles, not off-road recreational vehicles. So they're good. If those just had off-road registrations, then they would be guilty of riding an off-road vehicle on a town road.
So where I was going for a second there was Vegetation Control Service would make most of their considerable profit treating transmission lines. And so pitch pine that's going to interfere with transmission is a no-no. So they came out here with a couple of different tank mixes to find out how to treat pitch pine and maintain some vegetation that was desirable, that wasn't going to interfere with the power lines. So what they came up with was, in the winter, above 32 degrees, using a mist blower, you can kill pitch pine and not have any non-target effects because everybody else is dormant. Some people have applied it very successfully and others haven't. We don't have any problem regenerating pitch pine. Sometimes we have a problem.
Sometimes we have the problem the other way around. We regenerate too much pitch pine. All right, any other questions, or we're going to move on to the final stop?
I think we should move on.
Okay.